Scripture reading today is Genesis 45, 4 through 8. Genesis 45, 4 through 8. So Joseph said to his brothers, "Come near to me, please." And they came near. And he said, "I am your brother Joseph, whom you sold into Egypt. And now do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here. For God sent me here before you to preserve life. For the famine has been in the land these 2 years. And there are yet 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvest. And God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to keep alive for you many survivors. So it was not you who sent me here, but God. He has made me a father to Pharaoh and lord of all his house and ruler over all the land of Egypt."
Good morning. Do you like how I cleverly arranged to have Joseph read a verse about Joseph? That's also the reason I don't preach about Melchizedek. We've not yet found anybody to do the scripture reading. But we're going to take a look at Genesis chapter 45, and the passage was just read for us, verses 4 through 8. And there are some phrases in the descriptions of Joseph, of his life, that I think call attention to a lesson we could all learn from. When we look in Genesis 45, 4 through 8, we just had it read to us, the scene is this, that Joseph, after all the terrible events of his life, and if you don't remember them, that's okay, we're going to get back to them in just a moment. After lots of terrible things in his life that have befallen him, lots of suffering, reunites with the people who, a fairly simple reading of the text would indicate, were responsible for all of his problems. Any of us had gone through that story and lived that life, or even just read about it, we would know who is to blame for all of the misfortune, the slavery, the imprisonment, the hardship of Joseph. It's these guys. And he has now discovered himself in a position of considerable power over them. And so in revealing himself to them, the first question that really he addresses, and that's certainly going to be on their minds, is what happens now? What happens? What happens when someone wrongs you and you find yourself in a position to get them back? When they later on need a favor from you. Isn't that sweet? I mean, don't you enjoy that? You relish it and kind of put your fingertips together. Oh, you need a favor from me, right? That's an enjoyable human emotion to be in that situation. And Joseph finds himself in exactly that spot. More so, with not petty grievances, but life and death had been in the balance, and now life and death is in his hand. The strange thing then that happens is that Joseph doesn't see it that way at all. In the text, Joseph describes what happens to him briefly, but towards the end of the text, when he's summarizing the events of his life and his misfortune and tragedy, he describes it instead like this, "And God sent me before you. God sent me before you to preserve life. God sent me before you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to keep alive for you many survivors. So it was not you who sent me here, but God." And notice even that phrase I have in the yellow text there, that he doesn't even offer to divide up responsibility. He doesn't even say, you did some of it, and then God did a whole bunch of it. The way he describes it, and he says, you had essentially nothing to do with it. God is responsible for me being here, and wonderful good things have resulted from God's work. Well, let's take a moment then and go back and read what it is that Joseph's referring to. Just flip in your Bible for just a moment back to Genesis chapter 37. And I'm going to do a lengthy reading, and it's not going to be on the screen, so you'll have to either follow along or listen carefully. I'm going to read verses 12 through 36, and this isn't the whole of the story of Joseph, but this is the beginning of all the bad stuff that follows. And here's what I want you to do. As I read these verses, this is what I want from you. I want you to make a mental note every time the text of Genesis says something that God did. Good, bad, or indifferent, every time God does something, I want you to make a note so we can talk about it at the end. Genesis 37, 12 through 36. Now his brothers went to pasture. Their father's flock near Shechem. And Israel said to Joseph, "Are not your brothers pasturing the flock at Shechem? Come, I will send you to them." And he said to them, "Here I am." And he said to him, "Go now, see if it is well with your brothers and with the flock, and bring me word." So he sent him from the valley of Hebron, and he came to Shechem. And a man found him wandering in the fields, and the man asked him, "What are you seeking?" "I'm seeking my brothers." And he said, "Tell me, please, where they are pasturing the flock." And the man said, "Well, they have gone away, for I heard them. Let us go to Dothan." So Joseph went after his brothers and found them at Dothan. They saw him from afar, and before he came near to them, they conspired against him to kill him. They said to one another, "Here comes this dreamer. Now, come, let us kill him and throw him into one of the pits. Then we will say that a fierce animal has devoured him, and we will see what will become of his dreams." But when Reuben heard it, he rescued him out of their hands, saying, "Let us not take his life." And Reuben said to them, "Shed no blood. Throw him into this pit here in the wilderness, but do not lay a hand on him, that he might rescue him out of their hand to restore him to his father." So when Joseph came to his brothers, they stripped him of his robe, the robe of many colors that he wore, and they took him and threw him into a pit. The pit was empty, and there was no water in it. Then they sat down to eat. And looking up, they saw a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels bearing gum, balm, and myrrh on their way to carry it down to Egypt. Then Judah said to his brothers, "What profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he is our brother, our own flesh." And his brothers listened to him. Then the Midianite traders passed by, and they drew Joseph up and lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. And they took Joseph to Egypt. When Reuben returned to the pit and saw that Joseph was not in the pit, he tore his clothes and returned to his brothers and said, "The boy is gone, and I, where shall I go?" Then they took Joseph's robe and slaughtered a goat and dipped the robe in the blood. And they sent the robe of many colors and brought it to their father and said, "This we have found. Please identify whether it is your son's robe or not." And he identified it and said, "It is my son's robe. A fierce animal has devoured him. Joseph is without doubt torn to pieces." Then Jacob tore his garments and put sackcloth on his loins and mourned for his son many days. All his sons and all his daughters rose up to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted and said, "No, I shall go down to Sheol to my son mourning." This father wept for his son. Meanwhile, the Midianites had sold him to Egypt, to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard. What happened in this story? Did you take note of all the things that God did? It was a really short list. God is not said to have done anything. If you want, you can attribute some things to him. But in the text, the narrator of Genesis, directed by himself, by God himself to write that, doesn't attribute to anything God. Right? Nothing attributed to God. In fact, it would be hard-pressed, even if you were to make a few up, what would you say God did? Which one is God? Is God the one who says, "Hey, let's kill our brother"? Is God the one that says, "Hey, let's throw him in a pit"? Even Reuben, who we would like to give a little bit of credit, I don't know if he gets really a lot of credit in this story. He doesn't actually say, "This is a terrible idea, let's not do it." He just says, "Well, let's throw him in a pit." And while it might have been out of some love towards his brother, the text even hints that even he might have had an ulterior motive. He said he wanted to present him alive to his father. He wants to be the brother who finds Joseph and says, "Oh, here he is." So even he may have had a little bit of a shady motive. We don't know. Judah, now let me just mention this. If you're writing a history of your people and all your kings are descendants of Judah, this is a good place to tell a good story about Judah. Does this make Judah look good? No, sir. Judah's a mess. Judah says, "Well, there's no reason to kill him when we can sell him." Well, this is a great idea. Which of these things does God do? So this is our challenge when we read this text, is that we wonder, why is it that Joseph is so convinced, "You didn't do this, God did"? Is Joseph naive? Are his brothers right? They say he's a dreamer. Let's see where his dreams go. Maybe he's just a naive optimist. Maybe he just can't see anything bad in the world. Did Joseph remember it wrong? I got to tell you, if this happens to you, you don't remember it wrong. You remember everybody involved. You make a list that you repeat before you go to bed. Reuben, Judah. Oh, he knows exactly who is involved. He doesn't remember it wrong. So what's going on here? At the end of the story of Joseph, if you want to skip ahead to Genesis chapter 50, this question of what will Joseph remember comes up again in a memorable way. And I think it's even more memorable in Genesis chapter 50 because you get two accounts of how to remember the same story. But it's different from the way you tell stories with your family. I've mentioned this before. What happens, don't look at the screen yet, don't want to give it away. What happens when you get together at Thanksgiving and tell stories with your family? You and your brother or sister or whoever, no one remembers them the same way. In fact, everyone remembers the story in a way that makes them look the best. Right? My brother Clint remembers how he helped me to grow in confidence and courage and manhood. I remember him tying me up in the woods and leaving me for dead. Right? The way we remember that story is very different based on which one's telling it. Okay? These brothers remember the story differently, but not in a way that makes them look good. What do their brothers remember? Look in verses 15 through 18 of Genesis chapter 50. This is how the book ends. When Joseph's brothers saw that their father was dead, they said, "It may be that Joseph will hate us and pay us back for all the evil that we did to him." So they sent a message to Joseph saying, "Your father gave this command before he died. Say to Joseph, please forgive the transgression of your brothers and their sin because they did evil to you. And now please forgive the transgression of the servants of the God of your father." Joseph wept when they spoke to him. His brothers also came and fell down before him and said, "Behold, we are your servants." What do the brothers remember? Years have passed. Joseph has forgiven them, and they think, well, we know what forgiveness is. Forgiveness is not wanting to look bad in front of Dad. But Dad's dead now. And what do they expect? The guilt of a lifetime rushes back in, and they expect to be treated the same way they had treated him, if not worse. They expect, finally, that axe that has been swinging over their necks to descend. They've been waiting for it. Can you imagine how sad their lives must have been in Egypt? Every day, and that's what this reveals to me, every day they must have been waiting. This is going to be the day. The Egyptian guards come knock on my door, and Joseph says, "Yeah, I remember now, you're all dead. This is it." And now father's dead, and they say, "This is it, this is the day. This is the day he finally gets even." This is how they remember the story. "It may be that Joseph will hate us and pay us back for all the evil that we did to him." And they even contrive a little story. This is cute, isn't it? "Well, you know, before Dad died, Dad said, don't kill us." You remember that, don't you, Joseph? "Dad said that, don't kill us." Okay. A little desperation there. What do we learn from the brothers? When history and memory belong to and is steeped in evil, then vengeance is all you have to expect. These were men who had done a terrible thing and had let that terrible thing be the guiding force of their lives. And because of that unresolved evil in their past, all they could imagine is that someone would do to them what they had once done. Even after their brother had an opportunity to do it and passes on it. Remember, this isn't scene one, this is scene two. The first time they meet Joseph, and he passes on it, and he shows them mercy and kindness and feeds the family and takes them all in. Even after that, they are completely unconvinced that they are off the hook. They still, to this moment, years down the road, expect death. Evil in their past, evil in their future. And that's not an unreasonable expectation. The book of James says it like this: "Judgment is without mercy to one who has shown no mercy." These brothers had shown to their brother nothing of the mercy that they now would have liked to have had themselves. What could they expect? What could they possibly expect? When evil reigns in our history, in our past, in our memory, we can't expect anything but evil in our future. But listen instead to what Joseph does, and I hope we can begin to see the difference in this relationship. In verses 19 through 21, remember already in verse 17, Joseph is weeping. Why is Joseph weeping? I want to suggest to you it's because he is now figuring out that all these years his brothers have still been waiting for him to kill them. That all these years they have never once actually believed that they were forgiven. Instead, he has to repeat himself, and here's what he says in verse 19. But Joseph said to them, "Do not fear, for am I in the place of God? As for you, you meant evil against me, but God meant it for good, to bring it about that many people should be kept alive as they are today. So do not fear. I will provide for you and your little ones." Thus he comforted them and spoke kindly to them. Lots of beautiful things going on in that passage. We could talk about the providence of God, and actually when I started writing the sermon, that was the direction I was going. I was thinking, this is a good sermon about providence. This passage is about providence. Look, you meant something evil, but God meant it for good. God ends up saving not only them, but their descendants, and their descendants, 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 because of this. But the part of that passage that stuck out to me this time around as I read it, you know how the Bible works, right? You read it and you read it and you read it, and then God slips something new in there when you're not looking, and it's the same thing you've read 100 times, but it's something that, hey, look at that. And here's what I read, and I noticed, "Do not fear, for am I in the place of God?" Why does Joseph see his life this way? We asked this question a moment ago. Is he naive? Does he remember poorly? Does he just not know what happened? Does he have an inside track that we don't have? Listen to what he says. "Do not fear, for am I in the place of God?" He doesn't even say to his brothers, "Don't you believe that I've forgiven you?" He doesn't even say, "Look at how magnificently merciful I can be." What he says is, "Who do you think I am?" Joseph doesn't believe he has the right to hold this grudge. It's not that he's a magnificent person and has summoned up the mercy to forgive them. He says, "It was never my right in the first place. The past, my memory of the past, the things that have happened, these belong to the Lord our God. They are His. If He wants to sort out rights and wrongs and pay back people in judgment, that'll be up to Him. But it doesn't belong to me. Who do you think I am? I am not a divine being who can scour back through personal history and figure out who did what and say, here comes judgment. God has that power. Not even the father of Pharaoh, as he calls himself, has that power. Who do you think I am? I'm not God." And I think this is a profound lesson for us. If you look at the wrongs in your life, and there are plenty, right? And you try to find within yourself this human well of mercy, and you think, well, if I'm just a good enough person, I'll be able to forgive people. I'm going to suggest to you, you might not ever be that good a person. Sorry about that. It's just the way it is. I don't know that any of us are going to look far enough and find enough mercy. Maybe it's not supposed to be in you to start with. Joseph never claims that he has enough mercy for everybody. He says, it's just not my place to do anything else. The scriptures say it this way. "Vengeance is mine. I will repay, saith the Lord." It was never ours in the first place. That's maybe what we should be looking for. Instead of looking for mercy that isn't there, maybe we should start by looking for vengeance and finding out that's not there either. It doesn't belong to us. And how we view our lives and the past hinges then on this decision of who history belongs to. You can make yourself God over history and look back and say, I'm going to right all the wrongs that have ever been done. And there are people in personal life, in political life, in every phase of community life who are trying to do exactly that. To fix a millennia of wrongs, starting with me. But ultimately, the choice that Joseph makes is, those aren't mine to fix, and they never were. What was the end of that verse in James? Mercy triumphs over judgment, especially when you realize the judgment was never yours to begin with. This is exactly how we see people in the Scriptures acting when they come to know who God is. Listen to Paul in Philippians chapter 1, 12 through 14. I want you to know, brothers, that what has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel, so that it has become known throughout the whole imperial guard and to all the rest that my imprisonment is for Christ. And most of the brothers, having become confident in the Lord by my imprisonment, are much more bold to speak the word without fear. Here's the New Testament Joseph. Joseph's been imprisoned. Joseph's been a slave. Where do we find Paul? Paul, quite literally, is in a Roman dungeon when he writes this epistle. He's gone out because the God of heaven says, go preach. And did it go well? No, it went terribly. They arrested him for it. They beat him for it. And now he's in a prison. And what does he say? He looks back over these events. Suppose there's a written down account somewhere of the things that have happened to Paul, and then there kind of is. Which are the things that God did, by the way? Which are the things that God did? Is he the Roman guard that arrests him? Is he the Jewish court that pledged their own lives to kill Paul? Is it the man in the Greek city who starts a riot to get rid of Paul? Is it the captain that won't listen to him and so they end up shipwrecked? Which one is God? Paul says, oh, don't you know? What has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel. For Paul, there's what you might have seen in that story, and then I love the way the ESV renders that. What really happened? You all know what really happened means, right? What has really happened? So talk to your kids. You come home and something is broken. It's fairly obvious. Mom, what really happened was... What really happened means, I know what it looks like, but let me tell you how it is. They're always wrong, by the way. But Paul says this is a credible way to look at your life. You can look at all the superficial information. You can make yourself judge of all the people that have wronged you and make your list and check it twice. Or you can say, let me tell you what has really happened. You may have meant it for evil. Notice that Joseph didn't even deny that there was real evil involved. You meant it for evil. But God meant it for good. And God is going to rule over the events of this life. Even to the extent of how I choose to remember them has been submitted even to God. Paul says, you may have meant it for evil. If you keep reading in Philippians chapter 1, he acknowledges that. He said, some people out there are preaching out of contention and jealousy. There are terrible people out there. Paul says, but God means it for good. Even their evil has furthered the gospel. He makes a choice to give even his memory of what has happened in his life to the will of God. And that changes everything. Listen to someone else who does this, but this person does it before it happens. Now, you think it's hard. You think it's hard to look back and forgive people for what's been done to you. How much harder is it to look ahead and see what's coming and say, I'm not going to hold them accountable either? But that's exactly what Jesus does. Listen to John chapter 12. Now is my soul troubled. And what shall I say? What's his question? His question is, he is looking ahead at his certain death and crucifixion and the ultimate human misery coming down the pipe towards him. And he is troubled by it, deeply troubled. How could you not be troubled by it? He's troubled by it, and he says, what will I say about these things that have not even yet happened? Father, save me from this hour. That's one option. I could look at it and say, woe is me, a terrible victim of chance and fortune. God, please come deliver me from these terrible events in the hands of wicked men. Jesus says, but that's not how I'm going to look at it. What shall I say? Father, save me from this hour. But for this purpose, I have come to this hour. Father, glorify your name. And then a voice came from heaven. I have glorified it and I will glorify it again. Jesus answered, this voice has come for your sake, not mine. Now is the judgment of this world. Now will the ruler of this world be cast out. And I, when I am lifted up from the earth, will draw all people to myself. And he said this to show what kind of death he was going to die. Look at the chain of events in that paragraph and what takes place. Jesus is deeply, emotionally troubled not by his past. Jesus is a little different. He's looking ahead, and he knows what's coming, and it's terrifying. And he says, I have to decide what to say about that. You see what he's acknowledged there? This is the point of the sermon. Pay attention. You get a choice in this. You don't have to be the victim of the things that have happened to you or the things that are coming your way. There is a moment when you get to decide, what shall I say to all this? And Jesus says, I'm going to acknowledge the will of heaven first before I worry about me. I want whatever happens next to bring glory to the Father. And at that moment, the voice from heaven says, that's exactly what's going to happen. You can try to mete out vengeance to everyone who's ever wronged you. You're going to be terribly disappointed. Number one, you're not going to get them all. Number two, you're not going to fix anything that happens. Number three, all the people that you've wronged are now looking for you too. And it's a big list. This is a bad strategy. The alternative solution is the solution of Christ. I will look at what has happened and what will happen and ask myself the question, what can I do to make this bring glory to God? And God says, that's exactly what's going to happen. And Jesus says, this little episode wasn't for me, this is for you. This is how you need to determine to live your life also. You need to know what it means to live a life to the glory of God and not selfishly. You need to see how to look at the events of your life and see them in the light of God's will. Does Jesus now see a crucifixion looming? Look at the language when he describes his death. And John has to clarify for us that he's still talking about his death. Because the language has changed so dramatically from "I am deeply troubled" that you might have thought he's talking about something else. But John says, no, he was still talking about his death. But what does he say? Now is the judgment of this world. At the crucifixion, the mob chanting, crucify him, crucify him. Pilate saying, see ye to it. They thought they were judging Jesus. Jesus says, I am judging the world. Now is the judgment of this world. Now the ruler of this world will be cast out. Jesus says, you're going to look. No doubt, you'll see it, and you'll think Satan has won his ultimate victory. He says, this is the moment of God's defeat over evil. Now is the ruler of this world cast out. You might see this as the end of the appeal of Jesus of Nazareth. Jesus has had crowds following him, multitudes everywhere he goes. People don't follow corpses. This is the end of the ministry of Jesus of Nazareth. He says, no, no, no. That's not how we see it when we have God in control. If I am lifted up, not even crucified, right? We're not even talking about crucifixion. He describes him being lifted up on the cross as his glorification and coronation. This is the moment of victory. If I am lifted up, that's when it gets started. Now I will draw. You thought you saw crowds before? Now I will draw all men to me. And John has to clarify for us. Yeah, he's still talking about dying. Do you see the choice you get? The events are the same. Joseph was still betrayed. Joseph was still thrown in slavery. Joseph was still treated as a prisoner. Paul is still in a Roman prison. Jesus is still crucified. But by deciding that these events never belong to me anyway, they are within the power of the Lord my God, now everything is different. And it changes how you treat the people involved in those events. One more set of passages, and the lesson is yours. But here comes the hard part. When you start believing like that, it changes how you act. Because Jesus eventually gets to that moment. It's all well and good to look ahead and say, well, it's going to be okay. I can be optimistic. But when he's on the cross and he's suffering and in misery, he has a choice to make. He can say, I've changed my mind. Give me vengeance. Father, strike him down. What does he say? Father, forgive them. He sounds a lot like Joseph. And you can almost hear Joseph. You meant it for evil. God meant it for good. Stephen learned this lesson. This isn't a uniquely Jesus characteristic. It's what he taught his disciples to practice. Because Stephen finds himself at the same door of death, and he looks at the same angry mob, and he says, Lord, do not hold this sin against them. How can he say this? Because it was never his anyway. Vengeance never belonged to him. and he can give it away. Instead, mercy can triumph over judgment. The choice, then, is not for you to look down into the deep well of your human compassion and find what it takes to forgive those who have wronged you. I'm going to suggest to you again, this may be terribly cynical, but I'm going to say that it's true. I don't believe you have enough compassion to forgive all the wrongs that have been done you. I believe God does. Give history and memory, future and present. Give all of life to God and to his judgment and to his justice and to his mercy. And see if it doesn't change how you view everything. I love the way that God looks at things, because he doesn't see things the way I do. That's good news. Because when Jesus said this, he meant it for you too. When he looked at you, he doesn't just see all the wrongs that you've done to him. He doesn't just see all the sins that you've committed that are now on his account. He doesn't see what he's paying for. He sees people that he loves and will gladly die for. He died for each one of you to begin a life in his service, submitted to his will, within and without. And if you'd begin that life today, we're going to stand and sing a word of encouragement. We would invite you to turn to God in full submission, things present and things to come. As we stand and sing, won't you come at this time?